Feeling drained, foggy, or just not yourself? These may be the effects of low testosterone levels. Henry Meds has you covered. Our testosterone replacement therapy, or TRT, is available in pills, injectable, or daily creams. Many patients report improvements in energy, mood, and focus. Though individual results may vary, TRT may support sexual function for some patients. Go to henrymeds.com/TRT to consult a healthcare provider to see if TRT is right for you. Take the first step in feeling your best again. henrymeds.com/TRT.
The Last Word on Today FM.
Now joining us for today's Culture Club is Gareth Carr from Killybegs in Donegal, teaches creative writing at the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's University Belfast. He's written non-fiction previously, The Rule of the Land, Walking Ireland's Border. He's written a number of children's, young adult novels as well. But this is his first adult novel, The Boy from the Sea. Gareth, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What's this about?
This is about Killybegs, County Donegal. A baby is found abandoned on the shore near the town, and he's adopted by a fishing family called the Bonners, Ambrose and his wife Christine. But they already have a son called Declan. And for Declan, the arrival of this new brother triggers a rivalry that threatens to destroy both their lives, really, as they grow into men. It's set over 20 years, so we follow the boys growing up.
What put this all in your mind?
What put it in my mind? I suppose there was a community there, the community I'm from, which I just hadn't seen in fiction previously. You know, there's so many novels out of Ireland about sort of rural life and farms and small towns. And Dublin is pretty, sort of middle class life is pretty well covered as well. But these fishing communities just sort of weren't there. And so that was part of it. I just thought, somebody's got to do it. And, you know, that's where I grew up, and I'm the son of a fisherman. So it seemed like I was probably reasonably well qualified to take on this job. So that was part of it. And I wanted to talk about the time and the place. Like, it starts in the 1970s and goes up to about about 1990. And that period, that 20-year period, is really when fishing went from being a sort of a small industry into a really major international industry. And so that's quite an interesting dynamic time, I thought, to write about. And it's a good way, that change of the industry is a good way to keep my characters under pressure as well. Simply good dramatically also.
Did you ever fish from the trawlers yourself?
No, I was never a fisherman, no.
So, no interest in it?
No, I guess I didn't really. I never conceived myself as going that way. I suppose my father, a bit like Ambrose Bonner in The Boy from the Sea, ends up feeling a bit excluded by it. It kind of gets too big too fast for him. And there was never any sense that he was encouraging me to follow his path in that. And I didn't require any persuasion on that now.
No, never a love for the sea.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I would say I do have a big love for it still. But I never had any ambition to be a fisherman like my father was, no. And it would have been quite common for boys my age at that time. So I don't know. I guess it has something to do with the way I just saw it not working for my father, I suppose. And so ultimately, the culture of our house encouraged me other places.
Given that you're a successful writer of young adult novels, why did you go, I suppose, full adult?
They were a long time. They were 10 years ago. I don't know. You develop as an artist and you get new views and interests. And so then I wrote a non-fiction book called The Rule of the Land about the border. So that was my last project, but that came out 6-7 years ago. I suppose it just, as I was saying, there was just a kind of there was a world there I wanted to capture in a way that was truthful, and it just felt like this was the correct sort of platform in which to do it. I suppose it's got to do with my own age as well, and I have sons myself. So all like fatherhood and being a son and being a husband, these kind of roles are really, they're really what fills up The Boy from the Sea. It's all about these kind of dynamics.
Let's go to your Culture Club choices. And we always start asking every guest to remember the first piece of music that they can remember buying. In some cases, depending on age, it's a single. You
yes.
have a single for us.
I have a single, although to be honest, I do. I think it was more probably my sister who bought it, but I remember listening to it like crazy. I'm not sure I've ever bought a single in my life, to be honest. But I do remember loving Aha's Take Me On when it was a big hit. This was 1985. So I suppose this is me first noticing music is something to get into. But I think it might have been my sister's, really. However, I played the hell out of it. And lately I've been listening to it again. And I have it. I don't know why. I guess it's age again, isn't it? Isn't that what happens? You start returning to your childhood. And so I've returned to some of the music I used to like as well. And it's just such a brilliant song. It has this real emotional sort of, it's almost operatic in its intensity and preposterousness, really. And these high notes that the vocalist hits there.
Okay, so, here's a bit of Aha. Take On Me. Definitely one of the ultimate 1980s synth tunes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Which is, I think it's kind of come back into style as well. And you may remember the video as well, which at the time was said and it would be the most expensive video ever made. And I guess it has the kind of production values that are more common now. But at the time it was like kind of mind-blowing stuff.
We asked for a favourite band or album and you've given us an album by a particular artist, but there's a good story behind why you've picked Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Oh, yeah, well, it relates to The Boy from the Sea because in The Boy from the... Well, in Killybegs at the time you had, and all over the west of Ireland, it was a magnet for a certain, who I call alternative lifestylers in the novel, which is a phrase I picked up by looking through old Donegal newspapers from the 70s and 80s. And these were sort of hippies, I suppose you'd say, who'd arrived in there looking for what exactly? I don't know, a simpler life or some sort of living more in touch with nature. And when I was young, I found these people sort of fascinating and I suppose they represented other ways of living. And so I found them very attractive and I used to sort of hang about with them. And I guess maybe at the time I thought we were all great friends, although obviously they were being quite indulgent really because they're all like loads older than me. I'm talking about when I was 15 years of age maybe. But one thing they did do was they lent me their records and got me into some pretty good music. And there was one particular man, I'm thinking of a fisherman, who used to lend me his Nick Cave and the Bad Seed albums, which I couldn't listen to because I didn't have a record player. But I had a friend who had a system for converting record player LPs onto tapes and he would do that. So eventually I got my hands on various Nick Cave and the Bad Seed albums. And the ones I remember particularly from those times were The Good Son and Henry's Dream, which indeed I've never really stopped listening to. They're always there for me, those albums.
From The Good Son, here's The Ship Song.
Make me lose.
Very heavy stuff for a teenager.
Yeah, I suppose. I guess I was, yeah, I was hungry for a kind of alternative things that I wasn't getting immediately from the locality, I suppose. So, yeah, although I probably preferred the slightly more aggressive, faster stuff in Henry's Dream, really, at the time, which was kind of rock adjacent more than that, perhaps.
How important has music been to you throughout your life?
Oh, I would say very. And I think it's kind of a bad sign in a way when if I go through a phase where I've kind of stopped listening to it. There's something kind of, and it's happened to me, you know, there'd be a phase where you're kind of, you've sort of stopped listening to music and you're just listening to the news or whatever. And then you kind of notice it. I think it's when you lose touch with joy a little bit. That's when music sort of loses its appeal. And so it's quite a important barometer for how you're doing, I think, is how engaged with music you are. And indeed, music albums that I had from those days, you know, mid-teens, late-teens, some albums, such as Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and say a few Bowie albums as well, have just always been there. And I just keep returning to them again and again. And I suppose I always will.
What about gigs? How important are gigs to you?
Yeah, gigs. I don't think I go to gigs that often, really. And the idea of a festival, standing in a field and seeing five different bands in a day, doesn't appeal to me at all. That just sounds awful. So I've never really understood that. I never went to fail or any of those, you know. I never, that's just too much. That's too many gigs in a row.
But you have definitely a choice for best gig that has not been brought forward by any of our previous contributors to Culture Club, because it's Iggy Pop, who has featured, but certainly not in Pula in Croatia. Tell us about this. When did you see him in Croatia?
So this is partly because of the whole scene of it. Although I do like Iggy Pop a lot as an artist and his music, but this is just partly the whole vibe of it, which was myself and a friend called Fergal, we were making our way around Europe one summer, and we were just kind of picking up bits of work here and there, and leading this really scrappy existence for about 2 months, and we ended up in Croatia. And to be honest with you, this is actually during the war, the Serb-Croat war. Although the coast was relatively untouched and there was still a bit of tourism. Italians were still going there to the beach towns there, you know. So, but still, we'd been pretty ignorant of what was going on. But there we were anyway, somehow managing to have a good time. And we were actually sleeping out on the edge of town in a football stadium, which is only a small kind of place, sort of concrete stands, maybe 10 seats high around it. So, you know, we're talking about a small sort of regional football pitch. And we wake up one morning, because we're in sleeping bags on the benches. And we wake up one morning, there's all these people arriving with musical equipment. And it turned out that Iggy Pop was playing there that night in the stadium. So we immediately got ourselves signed up to help construct the stage, which largely consisted of extremely dangerous lifting up amps and putting them in tottering on top of one another on tractor trailers. And then we got whatever few pounds we earned for that. And then we just hung around for the gig and Iggy Pop showed up and it just rocked. What can I say? But partly because we'd been there all day and we just felt part of the scene as well. I suppose we were being roadies for the day. So, but also what a performer, brilliant performer. And just an unforgettable day and night.
We don't have him from that particular gig, but we do have Iggy Pop live in Paris a couple of years earlier than that, playing the passenger.
Ah, brilliant.
Oh,
Iggy Pop, the Passenger.
Listen to that. It just reminded me that during that gig, he stopped the whole thing. He shouted to the band to stop because one of the crew has been rough with some fan, like one of the security guys. And he stopped the band and he pointed and he said, "Stop beating that guy up." And it was a brilliant moment of justice from Iggy Pop.
Before I take a break, I'm going to do one non-musical selection that you've made, and a TV show. You haven't given us anything growing up. Was there not much television viewing when you were growing up?
Oh, well, I'm sure I could come up with, I've watched probably a bit too much TV when I was a kid. I suppose I'd be the generation of the A-Team where nobody ever died. I remember
they didn't even get injured when they were blown up.
No,
there was never a drop of blood.
Helicopter, they'd fall out of the sky and then they'd just sort of dust themselves off and carry on. So yeah, I love that. Thunderbirds, which I've watched with my sons again there lately. I'm talking about the original puppet version.
Yeah.
Which I watched again with my sons, and tell you what, it's very slow, but I was obsessed with that when I was a kid. It used to be on Saturday mornings.
But your choice from recent years is The Bear on Disney Plus. What's attracted you to The Bear?
Well, before I get into, there's a personal connection sort of, but it's quite an interesting TV show. A lot of the episodes don't really have much plot, really. They're just a kind of about atmosphere and character interaction. So it's really not quite like anything else on television. You'd almost say it was sort of experimental, some of the episodes. And then others are sort of more conventionally dramatic and there's kind of clashes going on. I suppose one thing that when I started watching, when I first, almost from the first screenshot I saw of it, I saw the blue aprons, I saw the white t-shirts, I saw the stainless steel bowls, and I was immediately returned to working as a cook in quite a few places, largely the United States. I'm talking about my early 20s. And I worked in a couple of pretty good places. I wasn't quite bare standard now, but I did work with some, how would you put it, difficult characters. And so it really brought all that back.
Why, is it realistic, The Bear? The pressure inside in a kitchen?
It's a little more theatrical, but it is quite realistic, yeah, and the sense of it being a kind of apprenticeship and this kind of complete dedication among chefs, and also that they live in this very small world where they have this other pantheon of heroes, which will be the other chefs from probably from the same city, and they're working in this kind of very isolated kind of place, and their lives are kind of weird as well because their hours are weird, so they sort of start work at maybe 3 o'clock, 3 p.m. probably like yourself, Matt, and work, you know, and work until 1 a.m. and then they only socialize with other cooks, you know. So it's this very separate world that they inhabit, and The Bear catches that very well.
What got you into it? Were you into food and wanted to be a chef, or was it just work?
It was just work, to be honest. It was a very good job for traveling. So you could, and plus, I mean, in the United States, like I didn't have a work visa, you know, so it was the kind of, it's probably different now, but in those days, you just come in off the street and you could, you'd get a job. You'd always get a job very fast, you know, and you could usually do it without too many awkward questions, maybe one or two, but you could usually manage, circumnavigate that. And so you could land anywhere really and be working within a few days. And so that's sort of, that's kind of more that we got. And indeed, this is why I ultimately wouldn't last in it, because unlike the cooks and The Bear, I was not into it. Like, it, for me, it was not a life for me.
Okay, the clip that we have, though, is maybe a little bit not from the kitchen necessarily, because this is where Donna, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, tells Sugar, played by Abby Elliott, about her experience of giving birth to Mikey.
I was walking. Oh. Yes, I was walking. I didn't know what else to do. I remember it was so cold. I mean, so cold. But, you know, I felt really good. Great. Like, I vividly remember feeling, like, really good and strong, you know? I mean, in between contractions. But like, I could take these stunning deep breaths. And then the pain would hit and kicked my ass. It was like a shooting star through my entire being. And I remember I would stop and pause and, like, hold on to a,
just like whatever.
No, you know, the parking meter or the street sign. Yeah. And then it would pass. And then I got to the hospital. I walked in and I literally shouted. It was like, hello, drugs. Hello, please. Hello, please. Give me drugs. Like, give me the drugs. And they did. And then, you know, Michael was born, and the doctor said it was an amazing birth, because somehow I guess he had gotten sort of twisted up inside there right up until the last minute, literally to the last second. It was kind of like he wanted to stay in there.
The bear, you're smiling away at that, right, yeah, Garrett?
That particular episode you just played, that is an extraordinary episode in season three. And it's just the two of them, Jamie Lee Curtis and Elliot, on the screen really for the entire episode. And it's absolutely marvellous, but quite difficult to watch, and gets at a kind of unsatisfying mother-daughter relationship. But it's absolutely superb piece of naturalism.
We need to take a break. Gareth Carr, author of The Boy from the Sea, is with us for the Culture Club. We'll be back with lots more after this. Welcome back to the Culture Club. Gareth Carr is with us, the author of The Boy from the Sea, set in his native Killybegs. But the favourite book or author that you've given us, across Washington Square, Henry James. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I read The Turn of the Screw years ago, but it's only lately I've been sort of developing an appreciation for him. And perhaps a bit like The Bear in a way. Wonderfully acute psychological portraits and capturings of people. This is what I keep coming back for, where even minor characters are wonderfully sort of vivid and sort of real. And, you know, I'm honestly not entirely sure how he does it, although I think the fundamental skill is he's obviously just a really good observer, really keen observer, and he's able to sort of get the measure of people in a way that he's then able to translate that into words in a way that really makes people come to life.
Let's hear the beginning of Washington Square, written by Henry James. This is read by the actress Jennifer Ely.
During a portion of the first half of the present century, and more particularly during the latter part of it, there flourished and practiced in the city of New York a physician who enjoyed perhaps an exceptional share of the consideration which, in the United States, has always been bestowed upon distinguished members of the medical profession. This profession in America has constantly been held in honor, and more successfully than elsewhere has put forward a claim to the epithet of liberal. In a country in which, to play a social part, you must either earn your income or make believe that you earn it, the healing art has appeared in a high degree to combine two recognized sources of credit. It belongs to the realm of the practical, which in the United States is a great recommendation, and it is touched by the light of science, a merit appreciated in a community in which the love of knowledge has not always been accompanied by leisure and opportunity.
Okay, Henry James, Washington Square. Movies. And the movie you've picked is one that you apparently pay a bit of homage to in The Boy from the Sea.
Oh, yes, this is Jaws, 1975, which if it's ever on, you know, I just have to sit down and watch it again. And then lately, my neighbour, I live in a terrace block in Belfast, and one of my neighbours put it on in the back. He used a projector and stuck it on the wall, and we all sat around and I watched it for like the eighth time. I always felt this was an important film in Killybegs. It's a very important film to my father. And I think it's partly because we were seeing a fishing boat as a kind of a crucible for drama. I was talking earlier how fishing families haven't really featured in Irish literature, but here was a story all about fishermen and a port town, and so I think that was part of the appeal. But then apart from that, obviously, it's just a brilliant blockbuster. I mean, some people say it invented the blockbuster. It's just a brilliant action-driven piece of work with wonderfully taut writing. And the scene that in particular that I sort of riff on in The Boy from the Sea is the very famous scene in Jaws where the three men sit around comparing scars, and it's wonderful bit of homosocial bonding in that sequence. I should mention, by the way, there's nothing like that in the novel. This is a case of where the film is far superior to the novel. I sort of riff on that a little in my novel, although I give it a female twist.
Well, we have a scene, I don't know if this is the one you're referring to, from Jaws, with Robert Shaw as Captain Quint.
You all know me. Know how I earn a living. I'll catch this bird for you, but it ain't gonna be easy. It's bad fish. Not like going down the pond chasing bluegills or tommy cats. It's sharp. Swallow you whole. Shaking. Tenderizing. Down you go. And we gotta do it quick. That'll bring back the tourists. That'll put all your businesses on a paying basis. But it's not gonna be pleasant. I value my neck a lot more than $3,000, Chief. I'll fine him for $3,000, but I'll catch him and kill him for $10,000. And you gotta make up your minds. You wanna stay alive and ante up? You wanna play it cheap? Be on welfare the whole winter. I don't want no volunteers. I don't want no mates. There's too many captains on this island. $10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's funny listening to that. I wonder if there's a little bit of Quentin Tommy O'Gara, who's one of the characters in The Boy from the Sea, this kind of... Because that kind of arrogance you wouldn't get from a Donegal fisherman, I think is fair to say. But in Tommy O'Gara, there is a little bit of sense that he is a special person and that the town should be a kind of grateful to him for in Quinn's case, it's casting great white shark. In Tommy O'Gara's case, it's creating employment and enable people to pay their mortgages. But there's something of that maybe. There's something of Quinn maybe in Tommy O'Gara.
Tell me about what plays you like.
Well, the ones I was when I was asked, I went for Brian Friel, which of course the whole family of plays, many of which I haven't seen. There's well over 30, I think. I suppose the connection there is the Ballybeg ones, which there's a dozen alone, and Ballybeg is Donegal, as you probably know. And so Dancing in Lunasa, which I've seen various productions of over the years, including amateur ones, but also here in the Abbey, never fails really to sweep me up. And that focus on female experience, wonderful. But I've seen a lot of these. Obviously, everybody's seen translations probably a couple of times. I know there's another production just recently. I saw it in Abbey, I'm probably talking 25 years ago. And Faith Healer with Rafe Fiennes, I remember in The Gate, been really, really taken with it. That it's a tri-monologue structure, so it's not really a conventional play in that sense. And yeah, these are those are all Ballybeg plays, which is normally placed sort of mid-west Donegal, somewhere around where Glenties is, which is not far from Killybegs, really. Although one thing I always thought was, for me, was missing from Brian Friel, which was the ocean. And his Donegal is very much a landlocked sort of thin town, central sort of highlands Donegal. And there it is, and it's a big place, and it's a wonderful setting. But for me, Brian Friel, just he lacks that one thing, which is the ocean.
Let's hear a little bit of a teaser from the 2024 Gate production of Friel's Dancing at Lunasa.
When I cast my mind back to that summer of 1936, different kinds of memories offer themselves to me. Well, there is one memory of that Lunasa town that visits me most often, and what fascinates me about that memory is that it owes nothing to fact. In that memory, atmosphere is more real than incident, and everything is simultaneously actual and illusory. When I remember it, I think that it's dancing.
Gareth, judging from all the things you've said to us throughout this Culture Club, you've travelled a lot, particularly as a young man, Europe, United States, whatever. Mm. You now live in Belfast. Do you spend much time in Donegal?
Not as much as I'd like. I probably get back there a couple of times a year. And I'm trying to invest my sons with a love of Donegal. And to be honest, it's not working out. They just think it's very far away and it rains a lot. So maybe I'll have to try it again when they're a bit older. But I go back a couple of times a year to the Killybegs area or Kilcar, which is where a lot of my family are from, is a little further west. And I tend to stay there. And mostly what I do is I just go for long walks and hikes along the sea.
But the fact that you don't go there very much, did that in any way prompt you to set your novel there? The sense of maybe a little bit of distance from it?
I suppose, yeah. It would be very hard to write if you actually lived there. The filter of distance and memory probably actually helps. It was very helpful to me when I was writing The Boy from the Sea. It was like a liberating moment when I realised I could treat this as historical fiction. I could actually think of it, you know, as instead of... It gave you a different angle on it that was actually quite liberating. that you're actually writing about a previous time and another place. That little bit of distance does help. And then therefore, maybe that's what leads you to write about it. It's also, I suppose, it's partly in self-investigation, my own family, my own history. And again, it's that distance that makes that seem intriguing to me, I suppose.
Okay. To finish, Buried Treasure. And you're the second guest in 3 weeks who's gone back to a post-war Italian movie. We had Gary Kemp a couple of weeks ago picking one. You've picked La Terra Trema.
Terra Trema, yeah. This was this is actually pretty hard to get, but maybe if I, you know, we could start a movement to get it on in the AFI or something. So that this was in 1948, and Luciano Visconti went to Sicily and filmed this among the townspeople of a fishing town there. It's based loosely on a novel, but really does its own thing. It's a very political film about the rights of workers. In fact, it was partly paid for by the Italian Communist Party. They sort of sponsored the project. What I love about it is it's just the way it was made. It basically just shows up with a crew. They don't even really have many actors. And they just start working with the townspeople. They work with the fishermen, they work with their wives, they work with their kids, and they just start shooting these scenes. And as I said, a lot of them aren't even actors. And so it has a pretty ropey feel about it in some ways. I mean, a lot of the performances are a bit shaky. And sometimes the way things are lit and stuff is very strange and it looks very artificial. But in a way, you know, that makes it better. It feels really authentic, genuine, piece of work coming straight out of this community, coming straight from the heart of the community. As I was saying, it's kind of hard to get now. On YouTube, I found a version of it. Well, it's not so hard to get. The problem is, can you get it with English subtitles? The answer I find is no. There's somebody put it on YouTube with German subtitles, which is obviously of limited use. And I understand that even Italians need subtitles because it's mostly filmed in a Sicilian dialect. So even Italians find it tricky.
We got to leave it there. Gareth Carr, author of The Boy from the Sea, thank you for joining us for the Culture Club.
The Last Word on Today FM.
Feeling drained, foggy, or just not yourself? These may be the effects of low testosterone levels. Henry Meds has you covered. Our testosterone replacement therapy, or TRT, is available in pills, injectable, or daily creams. Many patients report improvements in energy, mood, and focus. Though individual results may vary, TRT may support sexual function for some patients. Go to henrymeds.com/TRT to consult a healthcare provider to see if TRT is right for you. Take the first step in feeling your best again. henrymeds.com/TRT.